Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Michael Lawson. I'm riding solo today. Thomas Fortenberry, my sidekick, is down in Charleston. And I almost did not make it today. So we're going to have, I had a little bit too much. I didn't say to drink. I know what you were thinking. I had a little bit too much to eat. So we're going to have a short show, only by a half hour or so. But we're here in Charlotte, beautiful Charlotte, North Carolina. And let me look at, let's see, the temperature is out here. The temperature is, I mean, is really, it's really nice out here. 53 degrees. Yes. And I hope everybody had a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving Day meal. Because I did. As I said, I had a little bit too much to eat. I made the ham and the turkey myself. And I made the stuffing. My wife made the rest. It was a delectable meal, if I say so myself. Had a little bit of taste of my Añejo tequila that I brought back, $100, $50 worth of it, and it was just a little shot at a time. A friend of mine came over, and we had a little bit of a shot together. You're not supposed to sip this. This is sipping tequila. Now, this tequila is delicious. I want to tell you, you don't even, I mean, it's not like you're even having anything, but you feel a little warm, a little warmth. Nice on a nice cold day, a little sip here and there. It's delicious. It's about 306, 307 right now, and We're going to have a show. We're going to have some people on the air. We're going to have our resident insider, Mr. Big Gaff, come on and talk to us about a couple of things. And we're going to have Matt Newton come on and talk to us about a couple of things, about the Civilian Review Board here in Charlotte. And we're going to have a few little nicks and knacks here and there to make this go nice and easy. We're going to play some of the nonsense. This is not our year-end review of the nonsense, but this is some of the nonsense that the Regressive Party has been speaking about Obama. And, you know, can't understand. How do they claim that this moo-moo senator, and I use that word likely, Ted Cruz, can run for president when we don't even know if his father's in this country legally? Because, you know, he skipped right over from Cuba, jumped right over the United States and went to Canada. And the only reason why Ted Cruz is in this country now, because his father conned an American into marrying him. But you see the child. Forget the father's sins. But sometimes they are passed on to the child. Because even though Cruz was born in Canada, he still could run for president. Now, is there something wrong with this picture? Why can Ted Cruz run for president and Barack Obama illegitimate? The other may not even be human. I don't understand. But we'll get back to some of that nonsense. But Chris Hayes, I want to tell you, he is so smart. Chris Hayes on MSNBC. Have you, you know, has everybody heard of that, the guy that one of the architects of the Iraq War, Wolfowitz, Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of Defense under Donald Rumsfeld, that one of the, was one of the architects that got us into the Iraqi War? Yes. Chris Hayes had an interview with him. This man was speechless. He was absolutely speechless. Wolfowitz couldn't even figure out what Chris Hayes was saying to him. Chris Hayes interviewed him because, you know, and it is true, and I never thought of it like this, but every single time you hear one of these neocons talk about a war, you know, they have never met a war they didn't like. They've always had some quick, smart-aleck answer. Well, Chris asked him, and believe me, nobody out-talks Chris Hayes. His bullets, his words come out of his mouth like a Gatling gun. And since you're a Regressive Party member anyway, you're not too bright, because they're not talking to people who are too bright. So therefore, you can say it's raining out and it's actually 90 degrees and not a cloud in the sky, and the people you're talking to will believe you. But anyway, I'm going to play interview with you. It's all over YouTube, but you need to go to YouTube. It's the Chris Hayes, Paul Wolfowitz interview. And I want to tell you, it's unbelievable. It's very short. It's about, I don't know how long it is, but it's short. But You will love to hear this interview. It is so unbelievable. And the thing is that these guys all feel that they can come on the any show and say anything, and that we're just going to believe what they're saying. Because, you know, what they say is all bull, but this is the first time Wolfowitz, it was dead air. He couldn't come up with an answer. So let's play this. Let's go right into this this interview with Paul Wolfowitz. This is about how the neocons always seem to want to claim if they don't have an answer. Let's blame it on the Nazis. This is the same thing the Nazis did. And right away, when you mention Nazis, oh, you're supposed to just, your hair's supposed to go up on your back, and you're supposed to be outraged that, yes, these people are just like Nazis. Well, that's bull. Well, you'll get the meaning. Let's just hear this interview.
Neocons appear to have reached the final sad phase of their trajectory in American life, now mostly appearing to engage in self-parody rather than direct the nation's affairs. As evidence, witness this op-ed in today's Wall Street Journal. That just might be the worst thing written yet in the neocon canon. That's saying something. According to columnist Brett Stevens, the Iran interim diplomacy deal is, quote, worse than Munich. And Stevens invokes Munich. He is talking about when, in 1938, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain signs the Munich Pact, which was a de facto peace agreement with Hitler. Now, there's something called Godwin's Law you may have encountered on the Internet, which essentially says that when you get into a debate on the Internet about, well, anything, if you mention Hitler or the Nazis at any time, you've automatically lost whatever debate you were having. And what this means is that if you have a tendency to say stuff like, this is just like Hitler, when you're having an argument, it means you're not really arguing the case very effectively. Hitler is what you say when you're losing an argument. Whether it's Brett Stevens, who wrote the interim nuclear agreement signed in Geneva on Sunday by Iran, the six big powers, has many of the flaws of Munich, or Daniel Pipes over the National Review Online calling the interim deal with Iran, quote, one of those rare occasions when comparison with Munich in 1938 is valid. But of course, neoconservatism has always rested on a foundation explicitly of some version of Godwin's Law.
This is a sham from beginning to end. It's the worst deal since Munich.
Bin Laden and his terrorist allies have made their intentions as clear as Lenin and Hitler before them. The question is, will we listen?
We've got Chavez in Venezuela with a lot of oil money. He's a person who was elected legally, just as Adolf Hitler was elected legally.
I've often used that precise analogy of Hitler and Mein Kampf as a reason why we should take threatening rhetoric seriously, particularly in the case of terrorism and Saddam Hussein.
If every enemy the U.S. faces is Hitler, if every bit of diplomacy is appeasement, then we must be, as a people, in perpetual war. Luckily, Americans have largely rejected that worldview, but I'm curious to hear from someone who still holds to it. Paul Wolfowitz was the Deputy Secretary of Defense under George W. Bush, an administration that brought us two wars. He's currently a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank, and he joins me now. Mr. Wolfowitz, my first question to you is, given the fact there was a kind of reformist regime in Iran 10 years ago during the Bush administration, why weren't you guys in the Bush administration able to get this deal done a decade ago?
Let me just ask, I take it you think it's a mistake to take bin Laden's rhetoric seriously or Saddam Hussein's rhetoric seriously. That's the implication of your introduction here.
No, I just don't think they're Hitler.
I know what said they were, but when they threaten violence against the United States, it should be taken seriously.
But we shouldn't go to war. We should not go to war with Saddam Hussein.
That's a different question, but you're mocking the idea of taking someone's rhetoric seriously.
I'm not mocking the idea of taking someone's rhetoric seriously. You can take people's rhetoric seriously, but there's a few things to add into that, right? Strategic calculations about what someone's going to do, right? People can have bad rhetoric, but actually use that rhetoric for domestic purposes or political purposes that don't indicate what they're actually going to do on a strategic world stage, A. And B, the rhetoric being taken seriously when he invoked in the context.
I'm asking you, rhetoric was not to be taken seriously?
I do not necessarily think that all the rhetoric coming out of Iran is an indication of what their desire is in terms of their nuclear program or their designs on Israel.
No one says it is a complete design.
Yes,
that
they
rhetoric
do.
Isn't some,
Benjamin Netanyahu says that all the time.
Well, I'm not here to argue Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm here to say, since you started this on that foot, to mock the idea of taking threatening rhetoric seriously is a liberal mistake, if you like. Of course, Hitler is close to unique.
Close to unique. But here's the question, right? What does taking rhetoric seriously mean? I think you and I can agree in the abstract, sure, take rhetoric seriously. But when saying taking rhetoric seriously, and you see this invoked in the Iranian case all the time, because we had one of the leaders of the regime say something about Israel being a barking dog, right? Taking the rhetoric seriously is then meant as an indication they aren't serious about diplomacy, which is then used as an argument that there's a military solution as opposed to a diplomatic one. Right?
No. It just says it's part of the equation. And you know, to be honest, one of the things that's a little shocking is to hear how often people have welcomed the mushy, fuzzy, vague rhetoric of Rouhani as indicating some kind of fundamental change in Iranian attitude. Look, I think the real point is, forget the rhetoric. One of the problems is we made too much of vague promises which we know are easily reversed. Just on Sunday, Secretary of State Kerry was asked on a different network, I won't advertise their name here, what about the comparison between this deal and the deals with North Korea? And he said, oh, they're completely different. North Korea was a member of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. North Korea renounced Iran is a member of the NPT. Iran has renounced nuclear weapons. Iran is negotiating. Well, excuse me, North Korea was a member of the NPT until after 10 years they decided to leave it. Iran can leave it. Every one of those three things that Kerry mentioned are rhetoric which is reversible.
This is precisely.
Would you let me finish this time? Thanks. What is needed is concrete dismantling of their program, not promises, not words.
So then how do you achieve it?
And there's nothing in this agreement that does that.
First of all, there is something concrete, which is they're going to dissolve the 20% enriched uranium. They're going to bring
which
back
is reversible.
5%.
It's easy.
Sure,
reversible.
Everything's reversible, right?
Not everything.
Okay,
no,
so then the question is for you, short of war, short of a disastrous, absolutely horrific abomination that would lead to the deaths of thousands of people in the region, a repeat of the worst thing I've seen in my lifetime, which is the Iraq War. Short of that, what is the solution then?
You know, there is an alternative, which is to maintain the sanctions, maintain the pressure, insist on an agreement that really reverses this nuclear program of theirs, and not suddenly believe promises when we have evidence over the last 10 years that they have every intention.
So then let's say you don't believe it. Then what next? Then what do?
You keep the pressure on. You don't let it up and say we've got this great diplomatic achievement, which is also, by the way, going to come back and haunt you in 6 months. If the atmosphere is so good, if the progress is so great, then why don't you just keep continuing down this road? That's what happened with North Korea. That is the comparison Kerry doesn't want to accept.
Yes,
but that's how we got into that situation with North Korea.
North Korea and Iran, this is exactly the kind of thinking that I'm so fascinated, right? Because North Korea and Iran are vastly different states. I mean, North Korea really is serious.
The Iranians are a good deal more clever, actually.
The Iranians
will negotiate their way out of this much more cleverly than the North Koreans.
But you don't think there's a different set of incentives for the nation, the Islamic Republic of Iran, than there is for the Hermit Kingdom of North Korea?
Of course they're different. You keep changing the subject. The point is you can't rely.
No, that is the subject.
You can't rely on the promises of either one. And as far as the
agreement has verification built into it, doesn't it?
Chris, if Iran isn't after nuclear weapons, then why are they developing long-range ballistic missiles? They make no sense unless you put a nuclear weapon on them. Frankly, if you believe they're not after nuclear weapons, then I guess you can negotiate anything.
I don't know. I think the question is, if you concede they're after nuclear weapons, something that I simply don't know. I haven't looked at the intelligence, right? If you concede they are after it, and the goal is to make sure they don't acquire nuclear weapons, A, and B, to not go to war, right? And those two goals are equally important in my mind. Then what do you do that doesn't look like this agreement? This agreement to me looks like a pretty good path between those two.
What you do is you maintain the pressure, you maintain the sanctions. The sanctions are obviously biting and obviously hurting, and hurting them much more than they're hurting us at all. This regime is shaky. This regime is having trouble at home. And frankly, another thing I would do, which is important here, I would not abandon the people of Iran the way we have, not only under this president, but to a sorry extent, I would say, over the last 20 years.
I'm glad you're
in Iran are the greatest hope for change in that country.
I agree. And I would like you to respond finally here, because you've said that before, and I have been awed by some of the courage of Iranian dissidents. There's a guy by the name of Akbar Ghanji, I'm sure you're familiar with him, wrote these groundbreaking chronicles of murders by the regime of dissidents. Incredibly brave, noble person. He and many other dissidents, as reported by Eli Lake and the Daily Beast, say they welcome this. They welcome this deal. There are dissidents in Iran, people opposed to the regime, who think this deal can give daylight.
And there are plenty of dissidents who are afraid that this deal is going to legitimize the regime. Look, I'd feel more comfortable at that position if I thought this government was taking seriously the situation of dissidents in Iran instead of basically, or in Syria for that matter. We've abandoned the Syrian people to Iran's ally in Damascus. It's shameful, and it's going to come back and haunt us. You don't want a war, I don't want a war, but a bad negotiating outcome can lead to a war just as much as too much belligerence.
Former Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
He asked him, what's the alternative? They didn't have one. They never have one, because it's not about figuring what an alternative is. It's about wanting to do what you want to do when you want to do it. Because we can. Because there's nobody else bigger than us on the block. That's the first thing. The second thing is, aren't we supposed to do this anyway? Aren't we supposed to create that war over there in that part of the world so the we can live up to the Bible's final calamity revelation? These people are all, well, I am not going to go there and say they're all fatalists, because three-quarters of them are just full of crap. They're not fatalists. They want what they want because they can make money on it. It's all about power and money. That's all what it is. It's the little people that think it's about faith. You have to remember, George W. Bush did nothing to help these faithful followers that he said when he got in office he was going to bring the Bible back in your life. He did nothing to help you. Bull. Just like Reagan didn't do anything to help you. Just like George H.W. Bush didn't do anything to help you. It's because they fed on the fears of the poor, downtrodden, white community mostly, but a lot of African Americans in that community who are looking for help because they have nothing else. Now, it's sad. It really, really is sad. But this is what it's coming to. You can tell people things that they want to believe in, and people will cling to that. We need to understand. There was a film once. It was the original Time Machine with Rod Taylor. I saw when I was a kid. And there was and I can't remember, there was another film, and I can't think of the gentleman who was in that. Well, they had the same, it was a sort of the same meaning, same thing running through it. You can't sit there. What they used to do in the Rod Taylor film, they used to, the Morgues, I think their name was, lived underground, and they would have the people upstairs who were living out on the top of the earth. This is after a nuclear bomb, and those people were all blonde and blue eyes and fair, and they were wonderful, and all they did was live peacefully, and they grew all the food, and the Mogs used to just come up out of the ground at night and kill them, and they thought they would kill them. They were bringing them down under the ground to work their machines, and they would do that. The whole thing was that unless you're going to fight back, you're going to be a follower. These people that listen to the Wolfowitzes and the Ted Cruzes and the Rush Limbaughs are all followers. They even say the same thing. The same thing. All the time. Not just the same thing. The same words. Mega dittos to you, Rush. When you have to greet somebody with Heil Hitler or mega dittos, I mean, and this is what they spout out all the time. The first thing they'll talk about is bring in Hitler to make you afraid. But that's what they do. They do that to their own people. But we're going to get back to this. Right now we have a caller on the line. Hello.
Hi, Michael. It's Matt Newton. It's Matt Newton.
Hi, how are you, Matt? As a matter
good,
of fact,
good.
I didn't hear you too well. But, yes, Matt, so tell us. How are you resting? Did you get some rest after last
I did. I want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving and all your listeners. Monday was a big night. I think that this is the first stop on the victory tour, and it couldn't be any more appropriate because this is where it all started.
We're glad to hear from you, Matt, any time, day of the week. Listen. It all started, but it started, no, it didn't start here. It started with you. And people out there need to understand that this is Matt Newton, who is a prominent attorney here in Charlotte, North Carolina, and going to be a major force in the political realm very, very, very shortly. If not already, he has brought a major change in the way the Civilian Review Board operates. As a matter of fact, the Civilian Review Board didn't operate until Matt came on board. And Matt Newton was the catalyst to make sure that people in this community, in Mecklenburg County and in Charlotte, understood that there was no Civilian Review Board. And he made everybody stand up, but the people he made stand up mostly were the politicians, because they no longer could get rid of passing the buck. Oh, everything is being done correctly. Oh, yes, the police are always here in Charlotte, North Carolina. They are for the rights of the individual. Meanwhile, we had 12 to 1,500 examples of police tactics, so to speak, that just were swept under the rug. And no recourse for the average civilian unless you had deep pockets to go after them. I mean, nobody should be more involved in what goes on in the society in any one of the counties or the cities than the people themselves. And, 99% of the police are absolute public great citizens. They are absolute. They're there to help you when you're in stress, when you need them. But anything, there's always a few that skirt the rules. And if it wasn't for Matt Newton coming in, and, hey, he made a lot of people mad, a lot of people angry. We're not talking about policemen. We're talking about in the public sector, like elected officials. He made a lot of them mad because they now could not hide behind the shield of, well, that's the police department, and we'll see to it that something is going on just to get you out of the hearing on the normal Monday night meeting. Matt Newton now made them stand up and take some sort of stand on what needs to be done. And you know what? It's not through yet. And they know that now because they are now on notice that people are watching them. Talking about the police, watching the police. We're watching the city manager, and we're watching the representatives that represent us in the city council, because the city council runs the police department, just like they run the city manager. So whenever they say, okay, let's talk to the police commissioner, I mean, talk to the police chief, go. Don't even bother with police chief no more. Don't bother with the city manager. Go directly to your city council member, because whatever they want, it's going to happen. So, matter of fact, I'm just running off the mouth here, Matt, but tell us about, give us the short synopsis about what was so important about getting the Civilian Review Board working as a Civilian Review Board.
I really appreciate all the accolades, Michael, and I can't tell you how much it means to me. This has been a 9-month process where we have fought tooth and nail for the reforms that we've received to make the Citizens Review Board an effective body of our city government. I believe that we didn't start this fight intending to make friends. We did this for the right reasons, to stand up for citizens who otherwise couldn't stand for themselves. And now there is a process whereby citizens can receive the justice and more specifically social justice if necessary, when there has been an instance of officer misconduct in the future. And I think that over the 9-month period, we have made a lot of friends as well, and that couldn't have been more obvious or apparent than having this new law passed unanimously on Monday night. Just about anyone you would have asked 9 months ago would have said that it couldn't have been done. Well, we did it, and we did it by reaching out to the community, being a unified front, and by talking sense and making strong factual arguments that representatives could not ignore, and that they eventually adopted. So I couldn't be any more thrilled. You're right. The future, there will be battles and fights to wage in the future. But for the time being, we have an effective review board moving forward here in Charlotte. We have one. What we won, and to just go piecemeal through this, what we won was a lower standard of review, which is huge. The board will be able to hear more complaints, and they will also have a much more leveled approach to the administration of justice after they heard the complaints. And that's what that lower standard of review accomplishes. There'll be more transparency. We'll know who's on the board through administrative measures, who's on the board, what they're considering, and what they decide. So we can, as citizens, hold that board accountable and ultimately hold the city accountable if the city doesn't listen to the board. There's also going to be a longer period of time for citizens to file appeals or cases to the board. There'll be cultural awareness training given to the board. And finally, and this is the most significant piece of all of this, because this was the final point, is what we achieved in the last 2 to 3 weeks of our campaign. And that was after asking folks in the community to send mail and email representatives requiring that they place in any new law that gets passed, they place the words entire internal affairs file in that law. We wanted to make sure that the board had that entire internal affairs file up front as soon as they received the case, because they didn't have that before. And we knew that there were instances where the board didn't have all the facts and they were pressured into making a decision based upon the time requirements or constraints that they operated under. They were pressured into making a decision without all the facts. And we got that. So at the end of the day, all of these reforms were passed unanimously on Monday night, and that was not just a huge victory for all of us that have put the time into this, but also a huge victory for the community, and it's historic. It is a historic victory. So we together have, and I think that your program has played an instrumental role in this as well. This was the first radio program, well, first media program I came on, Michael, to discuss this issue, and you with open arms had me on to talk about this. Of course, others would follow in your trailblazing footsteps, but this is where in my viewpoint, from the standpoint of reaching out to the people beyond just our organizational meetings and you know our Facebook and our Facebook, our coalition, and our internet page. Beyond just that, this is where it kind of began on the media level, and so I couldn't be more thankful to you, Michael. I couldn't be more thankful to your listeners, and this is just a tremendous victory for Charlotte.
Well, you know, I thank you for his kind words. You know, there's a couple of things that I think some people who are just tuning in, or you know, maybe they listened before, but that might not understand about where we were before you started this process. Can you give us a short rundown of where we were before?
There were two officer-related citizen shooting deaths in 96 into 97. In the wake of that, our city council established the Citizens Review Board to oversee allegations of police misconduct after they had gone through the internal affairs process, and actually immediately oversee allegations pertaining to the death of citizens at the hands of police officers. That happened in 1997. Over a 17 or 18-year period since then, not once, not in one single instance, was their decision favorable to the citizens. Not one. And
we're talking we're talking about 1,250 or more incidents, correct?
Yes, yes. Now the review board, and what we discovered is across the country there are review boards, and our review board in the very first place was receiving one of the least across the entire country, one of the least number of complaints to the board. I mean, they had only seen, of those 1,250 plus, and I think there are some estimates are as high as up to 3,000, but the fact is of those numbers, only 79 got to the board in the first place. And so what we're seeing here, or what we will see, is we'll see an opportunity for citizens to have more of their complaints heard to the board, so that number increasing, and then also actually having hearings as a result. And the fact is that the review board itself, and these facts all came to light. The Charlotte School of Law had engaged in a 3-year study to explore these issues. They had a lot of difficulty throughout that study because of the lack of transparency, lack of readily discoverable information to the public on this issue, and it took them that 3-year period to get enough information to approach the Charlotte Observer and have the Observer write the article they did in February, exposing a lot of this information. And once it did, that's when myself and a gentleman named Robert Dawkins from Democracy North Carolina, another young man, Kyle Knight, we brainstormed and we were able to, through our connections and our networks, we were able to bring together an 11 organization coalition, 11 member community organization coalition, including the NAACP, ACLU, Democracy North Carolina, Action NC, NAN, the National Action Network, A. Philip Randolph Institute, and so forth. And that's when we started to take a much more active approach in contacting our city representatives, attending meetings, and engaging in demonstrations like the mailing campaign, to get the message across to members of city council and also to be clear on this as well, also to the media, because there was certainly an effort to let folks outside of just our circles know what was going on. And everybody couldn't have been more receptive. I think that there was, once folks understood the issue, there was an understanding as well of the need to reform that board and give them powers to ensure that citizens who don't have the money, as you were saying, Michael, who don't have the money or means to obtain justice if they've been wronged, will have that opportunity. And moving forward, it's there now.
Well, you know, one of the things I had a question about is that why didn't – because when this whole idea of being reviewed came up, that was years back, 96, 95, something like that, I was originally going to be on that board, but I couldn't stay because I had too many other things going on. And, I mean, I just don't understand – how were these members chosen? And well, not chosen, but why were they kept secret that no one knew who they were? I mean, I don't understand the. I mean, this is not the secret court, the FISA court. I mean, why were these people kept? Why the names were kept secret? Why?
I don't know. I don't know. I think it serves the public's trust and interest better to be fully transparent with the members of every city board. We know that the Planning Commission is transparent, but that this isn't unusual. For other boards, if you jump on the city's website, you can't find out who's on them. I don't know, and so I don't want to be absolute in this, because I don't know if the city clerk can be contacted, but we do know that it was very difficult for the Charlotte School of Law to find out who was on the Citizens Review Board, and not just who's on it now, but who's been on it in the past. That was the information that they obtained, and they got that through a Freedom of Information Act request, but it shouldn't take that, right? We should know, because we should be able, if there is an issue pertaining to a particular board, we should be able to hold those folks accountable, because they answer, ultimately, they answer to city council, who ultimately answers to us.
Right. Was this ever addressed by the city council? Because I am sure the city council is the one that came up with this criteria.
Yes, well, in 1997. Yeah, and the way that it's set up now, at least for the Citizens Review Board, there is a system of appointment. And the one of the victories that we won is the ability to know who's being appointed. And we can't control, unless there is another to reform the law again. For the time being, we can't control who they appoint, but at least we know who it will be. And we didn't have that before, and we are asking. One of the recommendations throughout the process was a request that the board members be diverse and come from different areas of the city. It's our understanding right now that is the case, but we would like for there to be more transparency pertaining to who the individuals are and who the pools of individuals are that are being selected from, and that's ultimately I hope we will see the ACLU right now is putting together a group of citizens to act as a watchdog oversight group on the future of our board here, and the powers that have been instituted to ensure that they are being instituted correctly, they're being followed, and also from the standpoint of transparency especially, it's being conducted administratively properly, so that we can, on the tail end, insist on additional changes or at least additional action if the city isn't following through.
Well, who is the head of the Civilian Review Board now?
There's a gentleman named Gregory West.
Do we know where he's from? I mean, how was he? He was picked evidently by the city council, and is it done on a political method? Is it done by drawing hats out of a straw? Straws out of a hat? How is this done?
I don't want to speculate to the motivations of the to the motivations of the appointers. But
you don't have to do that. I'm doing it. I want to know how is it done. Yeah. How do they pick?
The way it works is folks who are interested have the opportunity, and everyone can go online and go to, I believe it's the Community Relations Committee page. If you go to the Community Relations Committee page, it's either that one or the city clerk. They have an application to apply for boards, and you can also contact them. So you can contact the Community Relations Committee at the city, and they'll get you an application to fill out. But folks, fill out an application. That gets submitted to city council, and whenever there is an opening, and I believe there will be either two or three openings next year, but whenever there's an opening, there are the city council as a whole appoints five members of the board, the mayor appoints three, and then the city manager appoints three. And so whenever there's an opening and whomever's next in line to make the appointment, what they do is they look at the pool of applicants, and they pick whomever they want to fill the position, hopefully, and you know, I don't want to get into speculating here, but hopefully they pick the most qualified person.
Okay, so now, do these people on this civilian review board, do they have the ability to see that something is not working and make changes or make recommendations to the board chair for changes, or is this terminology, board chair, is this just a superficial thing, and he's got to do whatever the city manager says?
Yes. Well, they do have the power to interact with the police department and to recommend changes.
They see something that is just not working correctly. They now have the power to say, no, we want to change this. This ain't working, Cookie. We can't operate like this. Or do they just bring the recommendation to the puppet master, the chair, and he give it to the real puppet master, the city manager? Who then gives
they
it
go
to the real
puppet master first. It's my understanding, they operate under their own internal guidelines. That they themselves have approved, and it's my understanding that under those guidelines, they would go to their chair first, and if there is a unanimous vote amongst the board, then they would have to take that to city council. And what is interesting is that they aren't under new disclosure guidelines passed by the city this past month. They are allowed to disclose that information to the general public. They are not. They have to go to city council members, and it's up to city council members to decide whether or not that's disclosable to the general public.
Well, wait a minute, because see, the problem here is that there's something wrong with that, because anything that the city council does by law, they have to reveal to us poor little slops out in the field, unless it has something to do with the internal problem with one of their members. But an open city policy, unless it has something do with hiring and firing and salary, there is nothing secret on the city council.
The problem, Michael, is how would we know?
I was going to get to that in a minute.
That's exactly why we have to ensure and make the, you know, it's on us. It's on us as citizens to make sure that we have the right people in office, the ones that we can trust and that will disclose pertinent information that can affect the everyday lives of citizens. I can always say that I trust we do. Will know otherwise, and that's the process. What's interesting is this, is it just so happens that the day that this particular law that was passed on Monday came out of committee. That same day was the day that this law, that this gag order of sorts, was placed upon every board of the city. I'm not saying that they were related to one another, because I think that they had progressed through city government separately, but the fact is that that's a very interesting coincidence. As soon as this came out, then you couldn't have board members actually speak out. And that's why it was so imperative that we got that last piece of the puzzle where we ensured that they got all the facts from the police department up front without having to ask for them. Because we were able...
This is my next problem I got, Matt, because how do we know we're getting the complete case file from the police department? They can say, yeah, you got it. That don't mean we got it. Because if there's nobody checking on it, if there's nobody receiving the dash cam video, if there's no one, a second party or a third party, how do we know it's real? We're again taking the word for people who have not told us.
Yeah, the fact is that we still have to have a certain level of trust in the process, and the fact is that's something that if the Citizens Review Board member has an issue with, they will be compelled to only disclose that to a member of City Council, who then we have to trust will do the right thing. Now, on the flip side, this is where oversight also is extremely important.
Sorry.
Because the fact is, yeah, I know it. You know, these things, the wheels of justice move slowly. But it's also important,
if they
too,
move at all.
It's also important, too, that we have effective oversight. Because once we know what cases are coming before that board and what they're deciding, and then what the police chief and the city manager are doing as a response to what they're deciding, then we can actually start to raise more questions. We will know who the litigants or the citizens are. We can get their side of the story and then really delve in more deeply. But even still, and this is that next phase, right? The next battleground here is getting that subpoena power for the board, ensuring that it doesn't matter any longer. Those members have the ability to independently investigate. And that's where the next battleground in Raleigh will be. It just so happens that the very law that the city claims prevents the Citizens Review Board obtaining subpoena power is the same law that the police department says prevents them from disclosing dash cam videotapes. So chipping away at that will create a new era of transparency that will see to it that citizens' rights, social justice rights, ultimately are upheld.
Well, that's not going to happen anytime soon, as long as we have that right-wing group up there in Raleigh, because if they're the ones that are controlling the process, that ain't going to happen no time soon. Don't hold your breath on that.
Once again, in you know, the biggest issue for us is redistricting and the gerrymandering of districts to favor one political party. And I think moving forward, we have to be resolute in overcoming those challenges, ensuring that we get all of our voters out to the polls, and that we start to stack the deck once again in our favor. So we're no longer aggressive. We can get a lot of the policy measures that are being rolled back. We can roll them back forward, get back what we've fought so desperately and hard for in the past, and then start pushing other measures such as this. It's the system, right? And we have to work within it, but there's hope.
Well, now, in New York City, the Civilian Review Board has subpoena power. And, am I correct with that?
I would have to. I believe they do.
It's my understanding they do.
A number of them do.
Yeah, that took a little while for that to come through, because people, the ordinary citizen out there, assumes that they do.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it happens to them or someone that they know, they just don't realize there's a lot of things that you will come across unless you have been involved in some sort of judicial process, you're not going to know.
Yeah, I think part of the problem, one more particular recommendation that we would like to see instituted in the future is the providing of counsel for citizens who go through the process, appeal to the Citizens Review Board, and aren't as savvy, right, as the counterparts that they're going to run up against, police attorneys and then attorneys for the officers themselves outside of the police department. And so it's something where there's still a lot that can be done, but for the time being, we're in a position where we will know these things in the future. Before these issues were outside of the public domain, we had no real ability to discover these things. And now it will be out there. I believe now that I think about it, Michael, of the top five cities in the United States, all but Houston. So that includes New York, and we're talking New York, L.A., Chicago, Philadelphia, and Houston. All but Houston have subpoena power, and so this isn't a novel concept, and it's something that boards across the country, and I would say the trend is for boards across the country to have subpoena power. It just so happens that we're unfortunately in North Carolina, and it's a little bit different in North Carolina.
the thing here in North Carolina, too, is still operating like it's Mayberry with a sheriff walking down the street and the mayor, whose only job is to smile and pose for animal crackers because the city council actually runs the city. And as the 17th largest city in this daggone country, we need to make the mayor the fall guy. That mayor has to be the person that's in charge of running this city, not a city council, not a county commission. We need to abolish both those positions and have one group of 15 people with a city council president that every single major city in this country has. And this nonsense with a daggone mayor who poses for ammo crackers and has nothing else to do is complete nonsense. That was good for Mayberry, but this is no longer Mayberry. And if a city like New York City or California, or New York City that's got 10 million people in it, that's going to have just by accident more complaints than Charlotte has in a year's time, if they can have subpoena power, we can have subpoena power here.
Yeah. It's about accepting our role. The way I look at it is it's about accepting our role as a growing metropolitan area that is competitive with other large metropolitan areas. We need to take up the mantle of whom we're becoming. And I think that the law that got passed on Monday is the step in that direction. It's making us, within the state of North Carolina, and even amongst other cities across the country, it's making us the leader. And that's what this is about, too. You know, it's about us accepting who we are and who we're destined to become. And hopefully we have representatives that recognize that. I'd like to think that the fact and it's unprecedented, and as far as I know, and in my opinion, the law being passed and being passed unanimously, I would like to think that is a signal of the attitudes of our representatives and their appreciation of what this means for Charlotte and how it portrays Charlotte to other, you know, other areas, other cities. We know that Fayetteville and Salisbury are looking at creating their own citizens review boards. They will be looking towards Charlotte as an example and a template to do so. Durham and Greensboro are looking at reforming theirs just like we did. They will be looking to us as well. And we were contacted by Boston. Boston contacted us wanting to know more about ways that they can improve theirs based upon our model. So it really goes to show that this is one way that Charlotte can make a name for itself and create an identity. That's something else that we need to do to establish ourselves as you know, one of the largest cities in the country and be competitive.
Well, I was just thinking about if I applied to be on the Civilian Review Board, would I have a shot?
I've wondered the same thing myself. Not about you, Michael, but about me.
I don't know. Yeah. If it's all fair and above board, do they bring you in for an interview? I mean, do they just say, Mike Lawson, forget about it. Circle file? I mean, how is this done?
I don't know. It's all internal. I believe what they do is they contact whomever they choose. And that person, something else to be noted here is that it is commendable what these folks do. You know, they work for free, and they will be working even more so now because they'll be having to hear more cases, and there'll be more cases coming in. But they also have to
– whole life.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, they work for free. That's no criteria, please. Anybody that's interested in helping your government should work for free. Now, if we're talking about someone that's working 24 hours, let's see. Now, the one thing that I can say about the city council, which I don't like, and that's because, hey, they need to scream loud enough. Because that should be a 24-hour job. I do not want my mayor, like the last knucklehead we have, work for Duke Power for 25 years and think that he's immune to payola. Baloney. Please.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, these city council people need to work 24 hours, and they say they work for 24 hours, but then I can get compensated for working 24 hours. They need to get paid minimum $60,000 a year. This is complete nonsense. If you want to act like you're in a big city, pay the people like you're in a big city. There's no excuse for this nonsense. I mean, hey, that's one man's opinion.
I'll say this too. There are citizens review boards that pay the members of the review board. Here, not only do they work for free, but they're also required to undergo Citizens Academy training, which can be a 50-hour commitment. The fact is that these folks, they undergo training, you know, they work for free, but there is no other criteria regarding how they're selected other than it's up for, you know, it's up to the discretion of our city council members, and they pick whom they like, and I don't believe that there are hearings. It's whomever they pick, and that person is contacted. It really places the burden and the responsibility upon us as voters to ensure that we have the right people making these decisions. And you're right. We want to make sure too that these people take their jobs seriously and that they're not derailed or their decisions are not influenced improperly because of the fact that they're working part time. I think that's something else. That it's commendable that you bring that up, Michael, because you're right. We need to have people that are spending all their time in ensuring that we citizens are getting our money's worth, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one way of doing it, is ensuring that they are compensated appropriately.
Well, I just want to commend you, Matt, for putting out and which you didn't get paid for this. You had to I'm sure you gave up a lot of cases in court. This is 9 months. This is a year of your life. And everybody is grateful to everything and every bit of time that you put into it. And
It's all worth it. We're going to save a life. It's all worth it. And I want to say this to, you know, everybody has been talking about Matt Newton. I want to bring up Tiffany Arroyo. Robert Dawkins was instrumental, indispensably instrumental. Same thing with Kyle Knight. But behind every Matt Newton, there is a far greater woman, and that was Tiffany. Tiffany, she carried the water on this and made this possible. And I just want everyone to recognize and acknowledge that I couldn't have done what I did, you know, putting the practice a large extent of the practice on the back burner, if not for Tiffany, taking up, you know, those responsibilities and obligations. And so as much as, you know, folks want to give me credit, all the credit is deserving and owing to Tiffany. Tiffany or
Royal. Absolutely. And tell Tiffany I will be calling her because we'll be coming in to see her very shortly.
I will.
And I want to thank you, Matt, for everything you've done and what you're going to do. And I there's a lot more work to be done with this, but there's a lot more work to be done in a lot of other areas also. And I hope you're going to be involved in these other areas too.
I do too. I think this is just only it's only the beginning. This is just the start.
Yes it is. I want to thank you. That's Matt Newton, the front man, the man that put it all together with Tiffany Arroyo to get the Civilian Review Board in place and a lot farther down the road than we ever could have imagined been done. And this is really a short length of time. We're talking about 9 months. I mean, this is we got a lot. A lot of it also, you know, timing is everything. And, again, I'll go back to a lot of these elected officials. The timing was everything because they saw the handwriting on the wall with the election coming up. So, Matt, you got them. I want to thank you once
again. We got them, Michael. Thank you so much for having me on the program. I look forward to being on again soon.
No problem. Thank you. As Matt Newton, the force behind him and Tiffany Arroyo and Kattery, a lot of other people, but they were the main instruments. And we have another call. Big Gaff, I'll be with you in 1 minute. Let's see who this is here. Who's this? Hello.
Hello, Representative Carla Cunningham.
Hello, Representative Carla Cunningham. How are you?
I'm doing just fine.
Very good, very good. I saw you at we were shopping together the other day when I saw you.
Yes, we were.
Yes, that's right. And I want to know, and I asked you to come on to tell us something about the what's going on with the health care.
Yes.
And, the Care Act is, we have I know the president promised to have things work better than they were on the initial rollout. But, you know, I'm so sick. These people tell us about, it was terrible. You know, it's like, it didn't come out correctly, so therefore the whole thing must be garbage. It's just like when you go to buy your laptop and you can't load the software on it. So what do? You throw your laptop in the garbage or do you get the software working?
You get the software working.
I mean, this is completely ludicrous. This is completely ludicrous. Now, tell us what you're involved with, you and our 12th District Chair here in Charlotte and here in Mecklenburg County. What are you guys involved with as far as getting this health care program up and running?
Well, my thoughts on it is that anything that comes with a large change, we know that in over 100 years, nothing had been done to reform health care in America. And when you have such a large project like that, you're going to have some kinks in the system. So we have the kinks in the system. And if we would go back and recall that when Social Security was put forth and we got that system up and going, there were a lot of problems with Social Security when it first launched. But now, you know, it's one of the best systems that we have. And if you start talking about taking someone's Social Security away, you're going to have a huge issue. So this is a normal thing to happen, is that you're going to have problems with the system when it first rolls out. So, and with technology the way that it is, It has to be precise. It has to be critiqued. And that process is going to take place, but it is going to take time before everything is online and operating the way that it should, especially when you're doing such a large volume of citizens, so, and throughout different states. So everyone chose different ways to do the exchange. Some states chose to do their own exchange, and then other states chose to do the federal exchange. Well, the states seem to be not having as many issues, but you have to remember that the states are not dealing with as large a volume as the federal is dealing with. So it's almost normal that you're going to have some issues with the ACA. But now ACA, I fully supported the president in the health care reform, and I still support it. Right now, my main concern is that we did not expand Medicaid in the state of North Carolina, and we are still advocating to the North Carolina General Assembly and to the governor to expand the Medicaid, because the ACA and the Medicaid expansion was designed to go together. Some people still, even if they fall within 138% of poverty in the state of North Carolina, they still would not receive health care services unless they are in the emergency rooms. If they would expand the Medicaid expansion, the federal poverty level is at 100%. So that would pick up numerous people that fall, you know, in that category of being poor, unemployed, and underemployed people that are making minimum wages. So
You know, what you just say is, can you believe that? If you fall within 138% of poverty, I mean, give me a break. Is that incredible? You have to fall that much within where you can get a nickel? I mean, that is just completely incredible.
Well, you know, now the reasoning that they gave that they did not want to expand Medicaid, one was that they didn't believe that the federal would have the finances to cover it. Well, that's not true. The federal has the money. That's just a facade that the federal do not have the money. And the Medicaid would have been covered at 100% for the first 3 years. And after that 3 years, the state would have only been responsible for 10% and the federal 90%. It would have did us justice to get some relief from the Medicaid, because the Medicaid takes up a large portion of the state budget other than education. And
right.
Additionally, it would have brought in 29,000 jobs in the health sector in the state of North Carolina. So we are leaving money on the table that will go out of our state, which belongs to the citizens of North Carolina. It is our federal dollars, and by us not expanding Medicaid, it's going to flow into other states into their Medicaid expansion system. So it's a sad situation that we're dealing with, and the excuses that they're laying on the table, they're not viable.
Well, you know, and what happens, this money that's going to be given over to other states because they'll want the expansion, what happens to that money now a year later? They come back and say, we'd like to get involved in that federal or that exchange thing with Jiggy. Well, I mean, is that even possible? That's not going to be possible, right?
Well, you got three. We initially had 3 years at 100% of being covered by the federal. We've already lost a year. So even if we came back and picked it up, it would have maybe a year and a half left on it. By the time we go back into session, even if we pick it up, we've lost more. So that money is going to still go to the other states. We just won't get that return on it. And that's not a good thing, because our citizens, we still have a very high unemployment rate compared to the national level, and we still are not a highly paid wage state. So we still have numerous people that are living at the poverty level, and they still would not be able to receive health care services because they can't get health care covers, because the ACA is going to pick up some people. But those people that fall way, way down, they still would not be able to afford to go in the ACA. So they would have been eligible to apply for the Medicaid under the expansion. And granted, That's 500,000 people, 500,000 people in the state of North Carolina. 212,000 are children. And then you have close to 87,000 people with some type of mental illness would have been able to receive services under the Medicaid expansion. And let's not count out the homeless people who are not as stable. So their chronic health statuses are way worse than the average person. So if you could get some of those people as well covered under Medicaid, you could possibly stabilize them, and that would decrease some of the homelessness within the state.
Well, you know, some of the things that really bothers me is that because we have a president of the United States that is African American, this is the only reason why this is occurring. You know, there are some that say, okay, well, I don't like Medicaid. I never liked Medicaid, and it doesn't matter if the person was black, white, or green. Yes, but those people are so far out there. There's very few of them. The rest of these people do not want this president, this black president, this first black president, to have any sort of legacy that he helped people.
Well, that may be the objective of some people, but I believe across this country, a certain group of individuals may feel that way. I can't say how they've come to those conclusions, but I can say that I have never seen it like this before, where a law was made, it went to the Supreme Court, it was law, and we still have numerous people that want to say, oh, no, we're not going to follow the law. And I've never seen that in my lifetime, and I'm not, you know, very, very old. But, you know, that is something that you have to think about and say, why is this taking place? And why do we have a certain group of individuals that keep not wanting to follow the law and do not want to implement change to service the constituencies of their state?
Well, the reason why you haven't seen it, because it's never happened before. There has never been law. Never. It's just like there has never been a sitting U.S. congressman that was not given a post in a cabinet for a president. Never. But we had Mel Watt.
Well, Michael, we're living in a different time. And I think last week on PBS, a young man was on there, and they was talking about, you know, our youth, and that what is occurring now is that hope has been removed, and they're saying that the next generation, which is our youth, are literally being boxed in and being set up like zombies, and that, you know, they're going to be limited on creativity, imagination, and critical thinking skills, and that, you know, it's the voters are responsible, and we're going to have to become more critical thinkers. We're going to have to use some creativity as legislators and our imagination, and I believe that's just what the president did, is he used creativity, he used imagination, and he brought hope. And, you know, if you don't have hope, then you'll lose that next generation, because something has to be different. That's what makes hope burn. Is when you have hope, it is predicated in that life can be different from what is now. And so I believe that President Obama said life can be different for a lot of people that are out here suffering due to the lack of health care. And so we're in that era, but I believe that it's going to be up to the voters to determine where our destiny is going to be and whether we're going to let some people be left behind or we're going to pick up and take them with us, because so done to me is done to you. It all works in a big circle. I am just as relative as you are, and you are just as relative as I am. So if you're not healthy, then I'm not healthy. And that creates an environment of disparities.
Yeah, but you see, yeah, you're absolutely correct in what you're saying, but this didn't occur with the Ted Cruz's coming in. This occurred with Ronald Reagan when he said everybody's got to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. But some people just don't have boots, let alone bootstraps. And those people, if you don't have boots, well, too bad about you. This is one for all and all for one. They don't care about anybody else that doesn't have it, and they don't care if you never get it because you did something wrong in your life that you fell in that class where you couldn't get it. One, you were born African-American, and two, you were born poor.
Well, so, I think what you're saying also, it is some validity to it, but you're right. But this thing that is happening now, it's not just happening to African Americans. It's happening to a lot of minorities, and I don't say
absolutely
minorities because on our Medicaid rolls, a lot of people think that it's more African Americans on the Medicaid rolls. That's not necessarily so. It's more poor Caucasian people in the state of North Carolina. If we even looked at, people don't even know that Greensboro is number three in poverty in the state and across the nation. So, I mean, you know, you're looking at cities and looking at it and saying, well, you know, how could Greensboro have the highest poverty rate? Well, you know what? It sits in the 12th Congressional District, for one, which was the Justice Department district drawn for the minority representation. So it sits there. But you also have rural areas, and they may not realize the impact right now of what's taking place by those people not getting health care coverage. But, you know, it's all going to come out.
Well, we had the saying that you got 80%, we had 50 million, approximately 48 to 50 million people who do not have care, do not have health care insurance. 80% of those people, this is going to be a major, major help for them. Now there's 20%, that may be 20%, but it's not 20% because when you take a look at all the overall figures, it's only about 5% where this may be with Obamacare, with the Affordable Care Act, may increase their insurance a bit. But what they're not talking about and considering is that it's going to help them where they will never, ever be one illness from bankruptcy again.
That is correct because all the pre-existing coverage, you can't be limited anymore. And I know for sure that a lot of people that have their children may have been diagnosed early on with illnesses, and the insurance is too high for them to pick up and cover. And now they have an option where they could go through the ACA exchange and get coverage for their children or their loved ones. And that pre-existing condition cannot determine whether or not they get coverage. It's just the amount of financing that they're going to have to look at. But additionally, in the state of North Carolina, because we chose not to do the exchange, that limited the insurance carriers. There's only two insurance carriers in North Carolina that are doing the exchange. Well, that made competition just go out the door. If you had allowed more competition, then our premiums would have been lower, and we would have had more options to pick an insurance company. But now we don't have that, and they're saying that because indigent services, hospitals still have to provide those services because they receive federal funding. On top of that, by them doing that, that means also that we're still going to see an insurance premium increase because they decided not to spend the Medicaid, and we're limited on the insurance carriers in the state.
Well, they're going to use that to say, you see, Obamacare don't work because your insurance is going up. Well, you see,
right,
before Obamacare even came into picture, because I pay for my youngest daughter's health insurance, and she's 31. I pay for that. I saw an increase in the last four years, every single year was a minimum of $100 increase. So it had nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act. It was only because this is the normal way insurance makes big bucks. for their board of director and their CEO. But they, now with the Affordable Care Act, you can go to anywhere. You don't have to buy insurance in North Carolina. You can buy insurance anywhere. And you know what you need to do, is you need to get, which I'm going to have next week on, I'm going to have this gentleman from one of the insurance brokers. He's an insurance broker out in California, and he can direct you how to get good insurance. But what I want to do before we tie it up with you, because I know you're so busy, how can people get a hold of your office and of you or one of your people that works for you if they don't have insurance and need insurance desperately?
What they need to do is, I can give you my office number, but I'm not, you know, they have certain facilities in the city of Charlotte that can sign people up for the ACA, but you can do it from your home.
We got people listening all from all across the state here and around the world, so they may not be in Charlotte, but if they're listening to this, they might be able to get a hold of you if you give them some information.
I'll give them my office number.
Yes.
It's 919-733-5807.
Mm-hmm.
That's my office number. And but if anybody wants to sign up, and we need youth to sign up. We need the kids, and I'm saying kids, but younger than I am. We need mass numbers of youth to sign up, because if we create mm-hmm. Oh, really? I don't think so. But if we get large numbers of youth to sign up, it increases the pool, and that will cause some of the cost to go down. And that was one reason they were trying to get youth to sign up, because they're less risk than what we are. And when you get to looking at seniors, they have more chronic diseases. And most seniors have Medicare coverage, but that's before you're 63. You know, you can go on Medicare, and then Medicare help. But a lot of people don't realize that Medicaid also helps seniors that are in nursing home facilities that fall into where they don't have, the Medicare only does so much, and they can get Medicaid if they're in nursing homes, and Medicaid pretty much will help cover some of that cost for those really sick people that are in nursing home facilities.
Okay.
So
what would you advise some people who if they can't reach you at your office, they can go on is it healthcare.gov?
Yes. They need to go to, it's a site, it's a health insurance marketplace. They can go there, and they can go to healthcare.gov. That is the site that you sign up on, and you can go there and shop. It's a couple of little things you have to do. It's not very difficult, but it does take a little bit of technology to do it. But there also is a number that you can call into if you're unable to, get on the computer, and they can do it on the telephone.
All right.
I was looking for the number to give you. The site is healthcare.gov. That's correct. And I'm looking for the number so I could give it to you. And I'm 1-800-318-2596.
Nice.
And I don't want to get off the phone without letting you know that Representative Beverly Earl and myself put together a resolution to request the governor and the North Carolina General Assembly to do a special session in order to reconsider on expanding the Medicaid. And we really want people to continue to be engaged prior to us going back to session. That is still one of the initiatives that we are still working on while we're out of session. But we need people to call in to the governor's office, to Pat McCrory's governor's office, make that telephone call and say that we're in need of Medicaid expansion. We don't want to leave 500,000 people out, that we're still going to have to be going to the emergency room and still having to have an increase in our insurance premiums, and also you know, just leaving out people. It's sad. We don't need to leave those people out because eventually we are going to pay one way or the other.
That's right. You pay me now, pay me later. What, do you have that governor's number up here?
Let me give you the governor's office number. It is 919, mm-hmm. and it's a couple of numbers. His office number is 919-733.
Your cell phone if you have it. What's it again? 919, what?
Yes, 733-4240.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to have his cell phone number, do you?
No, I'm not privileged to that.
Okay, we'll see if we see. Oh, I guess Art Pope is the only one with his cell phone number, and Duke Power. All right, I wanna thank you, Representative Collard Cunningham, and give us your district.
District 106 inside Mecklenburg County.
District 106 inside Mecklenburg County, and
yes.
We're gonna have back. You, I'd like to have you come back on probably, I think it's going to be next week. I don't know. Next week I will be able to do it because I'm going to have the representative from who's the head of the one of the insurance brokers and mm-hmm. YWORK and helped me a lot with my doors. My doors program went up $307,
mm-hmm.
and I got a down to where it was 4 years ago, saving over $260 for the
wow,
same price.
That's great.
So,
that's great.
There are people out there that will work with you and it will help you. But I just want to say thank you for calling in.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
And I'd like to hear from you and Representative Earl in the near future. Tell us after the big at the end of this month, see what's going to happen with the how many people we signed up.
Right, right, yes. We're going to be watching that number.
I understand now that it's been about 80,000 in California and about 77,000 in New York and 98,000 in Washington State, 60,000
mm-hmm.
in Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
where Mitch
mm-hmm.
McConnell doesn't want it. So, is he in another dream world or what? But that's another story.
And I believe that North Carolina numbers are lagging. I don't know exactly how many, but they're lagging
Well, we don't have a exchange, and there's no Medicaid expansion. So, you got to go out and get it on your own.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Cunningham from Mecklenburg County. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Representative Collard Cunningham from Mecklenburg County. And we have now on the phone, who's been waiting patiently, Big Gaff. I'm with you.
Okay.
Were you able to hear any of what we were talking about?
Yeah, I heard it.
I know you are an aficionado in all this, in all the health care and things that are going on below and above board here in you are still had tentacles in North Carolina, but you're now running amok down there in South Carolina trying to straighten those and they really got problems down there. But in the big scheme of things, Greenville is I guess high in cotton, as we used to say.
Well, just the governor here doesn't want the program and it's the same thing. It's gone, it's crazy.
You're not going to say too much about it. Well, I can talk about the governor because I know her when she was a little kid, but, we won't go into that now. But anyway, we're at the end of the year here, almost at the end of the year. And let's see, give us a take. How many films have you seen this year?
It's basically I see one a week. I get about 52 a year.
You get about 52 a year. And, well, you know, hey, that is, I think, that was about the what I did growing up. As many movies as I've seen, I'm sure that your change with age has not diminished your movie-going operation. It's probably about the same, or are you a little bit more now?
No, I'm more now. I'm supposed to go. I mean, but, you know, like this week I didn't want to go see a picture, and, you know, I mean, I still have to go because, you know, I mean,
yeah.
It's not the same. And the other thing is people mistake something. People do not go to the movies near as much as they think. They see pictures on television, and after a while they think, you know, that they can discuss it just as much as anybody that saw it in the movies, but they have really haven't gone to the movies. The amount of time a person goes to the movies is much less than they think. Now, when you have what happens is children, young people and children control the movies because the kids make you go to the movies. You know what I'm saying? You have to go and take your kids, and so you go. But people on their own, adults on their own, will not go to the movies near as much as they think they did. And but they see that they see the movies, but they really have seen them on television. And they after a while they forget that. You know, it's not they saw the picture. They don't go back and say, oh, I saw it in the movies. I saw it here. But people do not go to the movies much. If you go to the movies, in other words, a good moviegoer, adult, to go to the movies 10 times a year is a lot. That's considered a very good moviegoer.
Well,
they don't
go
to the movies that often.
But that's because that they're 5 times expensive now as they used to be.
Well, it's more expensive, and the thing is, but that's the secret, that's the power of the movie. The kids make you spend money. In other words, you could go into the movie, watch the picture, and go home. You can't do that with kids. They're gonna eat up $25, $30 worth of pop and soda and stuff like that. So the movie theater does not make money off the tickets. The movie theater gets about $2 or less off a ticket. But they get all the money that you spend for concessions.
Right.
And I've tried to say this every time I have a chance, I try to tell people. The man who came up with the idea of the multiplex, and when he built his first multiplex in New York, they had him on television. And the reporter said to him, I went to your multiplex. And that multiplex back then was like 6 or 7 theaters in one place. Now the one here in Greenville has 20. But they had like 6 or 7 theaters in the same building. And the reporter said, I went to a movie and I saw it, and then I went across the hall and saw another movie for free.
Yeah.
He says, you know, like he was telling the guy something. The guy says, we made it that way. You did not, you help. The longer you stay in the movie, the more you help the theater owner. Because if you ate in the first movie, you're going to eat in the second movie because it's your habit to eat. If you went
That's
to
right.
the first movie and didn't eat, you're going to eat now because of two things. One, you've been there longer, so you're hungry. And number two, you're saying, oh, I saved that ticket money, so now I can spend that on eating. So he says, we'll get more money out of you. He says, and the other thing is this. The movies do not stay in – pictures used to stay in a movie for months. I mean, 3 months was not a long time. In New York, you know, Criterion stuff, when Ten Commandments and things came out, they used to run it as Criterion Theater for years.
That's right.
The picture would run for a year and a half, 18 months and things like that was not unusual. For a picture to stay, a blockbuster would stay in a Manhattan movie theater for a year.
Right.
So the guy says, the way things work now is this. A movie only stays there a month at best. A picture's only going to be in the theater a month. So what happens is, he says, if you went to see one picture and then you snuck across the hall and saw the other one, he says, you haven't heard us because you wouldn't be back within a month. Like I said, most moviegoers only go 6 to 10 times a year is a lot. And so you would not be back when that other picture was playing. So we would have never sold you a ticket to that. You went to see Gone with the Wind. You're not going to sneak into the Caine Mutiny because the Caine Mutiny won't still be there when you come back. But if you sneak into it, that's fine because you're going to eat and spend money. So it's, you know, I mean,
well,
you know, I don't know why people think they're outsmarting the theater. Oh, I could go across and see. But they want you to do that. It's bad management when the managers accept
right.
on the weekend. They don't want, now the weekend they're selling out. Because,
right.
But that's it. But a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, who cares if you walk around and see every pitch? It doesn't hurt them.
Well, you know, the thing is, though, but see, back then when the Ten Commandments was playing, it was only playing in one movie theater in that city.
Right. It stayed there for a year, right.
That's right. And so it had to be there for a year for as many people as possible to see it.
Yeah.
I remember I was online seeing Thunderball and Goldfinger. We stood outside in the rain. I think it was Goldfinger. Stood outside in the rain for, maybe it was Thunderball. Stood outside in the rain for 45 minutes just to get online to buy the ticket. And then another hour to stand online to get into the movie theater.
I did the same thing.
3 hours a day.
I did the same thing you're talking about with The Godfather. When I was teaching in school in Brooklyn, three couples went to the theater in Manhattan to see The Godfather. We were going on a Thursday night. Now, we had school Friday, but we went on a Thursday night to the midnight show. The midnight show was running late because the place had been so packed that it didn't come on until 1 o'clock. And by the time we got out of the theater, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. We drove home, and then we turned around and went to work. But that was the only place it was playing, and in the debut of The Godfather, and that's just the way it is.
Now,
pitcher's going to be on television in a month anyway.
Didn't we do that? Excuse me, to see Batman, the original Batman with Michael Keaton. I think we were together. We stood online on a Thursday night midnight show. It didn't start till like 1.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. It's a you have to. These pitches are in the when they come out to the big theaters and stuff like that. That's the way you have to do. I mean, you're fighting with all these other. You're competing for the ticket to get in.
Right.
You're not
Absolutely.
Just going. You're competing. If you're not there, somebody else will be there.
Well,
so like
well,
you said, you wait online
think?
To get the ticket so you can wait online.
Mm-hmm. What is the direction of filming? Have you seen a change in the type of film that has been presented this year in the movie theaters as some years past?
I'm not the greatest one on these overall trends and things like that. You know what I'm saying? I'm more like I see this picture, I see that picture, I don't know any overall trend things. That's too broad a category.
I mean, the type of film that's out there from today over then the last couple of years. I mean, in the genre, I should say.
I'm not. I don't have that big perspective. You know, I have to be more. In other words, I know we had, there were three dynamic black movies this year, The Butler and 12 Years a Slave, and actually a picture I didn't want to go see I saw this week, and that was the Best Man Holiday. I liked the first picture. I thought it was excellent, the first picture, and then when they came up with this reunion idea, I said, oh, they're just milking the old thing. But it wasn't. It was very good on its own. It was a very good picture. I just turned in the review on it. And I'm surprised. I mean, they had a wonderful cast. The cast was just tremendous. Even the supporting players, the children in the story were wonderful. And it was very personal. And the people did things that, you know, they would curse each other out, but you got the, you understood that they were cursing each other out because they loved each other. It was concern. It wasn't, people made spiteful remarks and things like that, but they really cared about each other. It was a very good picture, very emotional. And I never saw a picture that I wrote this. I never saw a picture where they curse more than Pulp Fiction. But yet it's a religious-based type of theme to it. There's a constant thing about religion and you know, being godly or being doing the right thing. But they yet they curse like sailors, but the audience is not offended by it because it's not thrown in. It's just, I don't know, it's a thing. It's weird. I mean, there were children in the theater, and they were cursing like sailors, but it wasn't cursing. It wasn't stupidity cursing. It was like people just, I don't know. It was something that it worked. They got away with it, and it was just amazing. I mean, the foul language in there, I'm telling you, you would not believe it. Maybe that's what it was, too, that you didn't expect this. You know, because, I mean, they're saying, well, God will look out for you and redemption and things like that and justice. But yet they would say anything. But it was something. It wasn't mean spirited. I don't know how to describe it. They got. I mentioned it, but they just made it work. It didn't become vulgar. They were cursing, but it wasn't vulgar. I don't know how to explain it.
So you mean it wasn't like Durango?
Oh, it wasn't like Django. Yeah. You know. Yeah. It wasn't like, you know, Django was. They were just cursing. But here's my other thing. I saw 12 Years a Slave, and I'm telling you. And we talked about it on your show 2 weeks ago. 12 Years a Slave, I'm telling you now, it is just, oh, my goodness. It's the most brutal picture. It's just horrendous. There's no hope. I mean, it's just a when you see this system of slavery, and that's what it is really. It's showing you the system. There's no hope. I mean, it's just a hopelessness. These people have your complete life under control. They say, when they say you're their property, they mean it. I mean, you know, it was just a brutal picture. I mean, it was hard to sit through. And the thing is that I said Django should have come out after this. They should have had 12 Years a Slave, and then they should have had Django, because in Django, the whole point was that he killed these people. And they needed to kill him. They needed to be killed. They didn't need to have. They didn't need redemption. They didn't need salvation. They didn't need correction. They needed to die. These were horrible people, and they needed to die. And Django, in his picture, killed them. He killed every one of them, and they needed to die. That's what I wrote. I said it was retribution. They didn't need anything except retribution. They needed to die for what they did. So it would have been better if you had seen 12 Years a Slave, and then Django comes along and kills him, rather than Django, he kills him, you know, and then you see the picture about how bad they were. But
well, you see now, and I think we talked about that also. Our cousin in Canada says that she says it's just she didn't believe it, 12 Years a Slave, because of the character. The main character never smiled from the day.
No, I wrote my review. Let me tell you, I mentioned that Randy Parrish. I wrote her comments that she said that the star actor, the lead actor, wasn't didn't seem to appear as a star, didn't take control, and everything like that. But I said I understood it after she said that. I realized she was right, but that's because the lead actor in this story is not really the lead actor. He's in every scene, but he's there to be your guide. That was his job. His job wasn't to be – the story wasn't about the man who wrote the story. The guy who Solomon Northrop, who's the man who was kidnapped, the black man who was kidnapped and had to, you know, spent the 12 years a slave, and the actor who played him. In the story, they're not there to be the – He's not featured. He's like Forrest Gump was. Forrest Gump had to be in Vietnam. Forrest Gump had to be at the March on Washington. Forrest Gump was act things, but it didn't have to be about Forrest Gump. He had to be there so you could see things. This guy showed you how the people treated them. He was always there to show. He showed you like he would be at a lynching. He wasn't lynched. He didn't have to do any great acting. He just had to be there so the camera could come and show you what was going on. And that was his role. That's why he didn't, even though he wrote the story, but it wasn't about him. It was putting him in all these spots to show you a lynching, to show you how a slave was, no matter what they did, they still would trip up. You could do the greatest job painting something, but you put a smudge in the corner of the, you painted a whole house, but you put a smudge in the corner of the basement window, and therefore you could be beaten because you made that, you got one smudge out of painting an entire house or something. It was just, he was there to show you that, to allow the camera to show you. So his thing was more like a tour guide. And the story's not, you know, even though it's his story, he was a tour guide and showing you the hell of slavery. And it was hell. These people had no regard for you. They didn't treat you as a person. You were just a thing. And they made that quite clear. And if you tried to be anything more than that, they beat you for trying to be more than that.
Well,
you couldn't tell
what
he could read. He had to hide the fact that he could read. It would have been like almost a death sentence if they knew he could read, because they're giving you notes that are talking about you. You're carrying a note to somebody that says, when this guy gets there, beat him because he's been obstinate or something like that. So you couldn't be able to read the note. The note might be saying that they're going to sell your mother this afternoon at 3 o'clock. So you're taking the note to the guy who's coming to bid on your mother or something like that, and you don't know it. So they would, if you could read, you could be killed because you could read.
Well, then you're realistically, what you're trying to say is that he is almost like the Robert Mitchum character in The Winds of War, where he was at every single thing that happened, from the
right, right,
Hitler to Tojo to you name it. He was there.
Right. He was a bridge. He was the bridge that connected all these different things. So he showed you how a man could start off free. He could be lured to come to a border state. Then he could be drugged and kidnapped. And then how he could be, his whole rights were disregarded. And then he would be passed from slave owner to slave owner. And even though every slave owner had a little different story, they all basically were, they're slave owners. They're not, there's no kindly master. You don't have, there's not possible. You can't be kindly and be a master. You have my life under your control, and then my life is for your benefit. So the fact that you pat me on the head and call me friend or something doesn't make any difference. You know what I mean? I'm your slave, and that's the one constant. One could beat you more. One would beat you 50 times a week, and the other one beat you 10 times a week. Or, you know, but you're
but
still
you're
a slave
still
if they don't beat you at all.
That's right. You're still a slave if they don't beat you at all. Well, what do you think then, as far as the black films, which black actor or actress in the film has you've seen a change and they have really come to become a prominent actor?
I think you're looking over my shoulder. I sent my column into the paper, and then I went back and I added another paragraph. I said I have to salute Terrence Howard. Terrence Howard is just – I end my comments about him by saying Denzel, Marlon, Sidney, and it's going to be Terrence. You won't need a second name. You never say Denzel Washington. It's Denzel. You don't say Marlon when you're talking about the movies. It's Marlon. You don't need it. You know.
Right.
You know who it is. And and he's going to be like that. He makes such an impression in everything he did. Every picture, he does something that's just extraordinary. And he does the same thing in this one. And he did the same thing in the original one about the best man. Because in the plot, if people haven't seen the best man, the original one, there was two best friends of the best man for Morris Chestnut was Taye Diggs. Taye Diggs was going to be the best man. Terrence Howard was a friend. They're all friends. Terrence Howard made Morris Chestnut or Taye Diggs or whatever. I forgot how he did it, but he made them reveal that Taye Diggs had sex with this guy's wife, his future wife. So the best man at the wedding had sex with the unknown to the groom had sex with the wife. Terrence Howard made that come out in the original picture. That's what made that picture so good. That's what made it more than like a Tyler Perry picture where everything is just wonderful. They they put that in there, and that made it really escalate. Because here's a guy that looked like he was evil. He looked like he was evil that he would do this, that he would break this secret and expose the guy. But he knew that this couple needed to start their relationship in honesty. So that's what he was doing. He was forcing the couple to come, and if they might as well face this situation before they get married rather than find out later and be trapped and stuff like that. So he made them deal with it, and he looked like the villain. And Terrence Howard pulled that off because everybody in the theater hated him until they realized that he did it to save their marriage, to not let them get into this relationship with this lie hanging over their heads. And and that made that picture special. And that's why I didn't really want to see this one, because I said they're not going to capture that again. But they did capture it again, that same honesty and feelings and everything. So it's I believe Terrence Howard is really – I mean, and I don't think he's gotten his best roles yet. But he's when he gets finished his picture, you go home, you think about Terrence Howard more than any other actor in it. That's the way it normally is.
Well, didn't he win an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor?
The Hustle and Flow. He was nominated.
Right.
I don't think he won.
Oh, he didn't win.
He was nominated, for Hustle and Flow. And he may have won. I can't remember, but I don't think so. But
what's
was nominated for it.
Well, what's the line from that movie that's so famous from the theme song?
What is it? Hard to be a pimp.
Yeah,
it's hard to be a pimp.
Right, it's hard to be a pimp. These days, it's hard to be a pimp, stuff like that. But how about a woman? Who would you pick out as the best African American? Actors. Let's come up.
I don't know. The women, they come through, so often the women are supporting, you know, they're playing supporting roles and things like that. You know, I mean, there's not that many pictures where the women are featured as a star. They're more supporting, and they do a good job. Like in this one, there were like five main women characters, female characters, and they all had their moments to shine. So I don't know. But you know, I have this trouble I've always had this trouble that I can tell you male stars, all the male stars I could name. I go to a picture, I never could tell Gloria Swanson from Victoria Lake. I mean, I would know for a minute, but I would lose track of who they were and stuff like that. Because women just, I don't know.
They're
can't put them in the same category.
They're like in the Hitchcock films, the MacGuffin. You know,
they're not carrying anything. John Wayne is John Wayne. Clint Eastwood is Clint Eastwood. And that's the thing. Like I was telling somebody the other day, Sylvester Stallone said years ago, he will never make a movie where he dies. He says, I'm the hero. I don't die. You know, he says, I don't make a movie where I die. John Wayne made, with his early films and things like that, John Wayne made 150 movies, and he only dies in five of them. And I always tell people, one of them, he had to die.
Yeah.
Remember which one that was?
There was one of them where he was
No,
was
that it's got nothing to do with it. It's because of history. He has to die.
Oh, yeah, the
Alamo.
Alamo. Right. Alamo,
he
has
no choice. Everybody in the Alamo died, so
that's right.
So he was
Maybe
stuck in that one dying. He dies in the shootist. He dies in the shootist, which he wanted to do.
He died
in Cowboy.
Back to Batano.
He died in Cowboy where the young guys took over the cattle drive for him. And he dies in Sands of Iwo Jima. He's the last soldier shot after the Japanese actually surrendered or something. He ends up getting shot. So I just strike him. And then there's one, the Wake of the Red Witch, which I never saw. He dies in that one, I heard. And that's the only five pictures he dies in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's a, something that most people don't understand. But, hey, in today's era, they don't make 150 films either anymore.
Oh, no, no. Yeah, a lot of those were before he became a big thing. He did those little quickie westerns and stuff like that where they knock off one every 2 months.
Right, you know? Yeah, but it was also because you were in the the studio system where you were contracted to make three films a year, four films a year.
Right.
Which they don't have anymore. And, it's a major difference. Now, overall then, in the films that you've seen, black actor or actress otherwise, who's made the most impression on you this year as an actor?
Forrest Whitaker taking you through, he was more like a guide, but Forrest Whitaker taking you through the thing of the butler just impressed me. Not him particularly, I wouldn't say him, but the idea of seeing where this person started, that character starting, it's more the character I'm saying than the actor on this one. But it's like, here's a person that his mother is being raped as he and his father stand there, the rapist comes along, I was going to say the slave owner, but it was 1926. Nobody that sees this picture really thinks it's 1926. I mean, they put it on the screen. You know, because I still think of him as a slave master. He comes along, scoops up the mother, says he wants her to go inside and help him rearrange something in the house. The father and the son both know he's going in there to rape this woman, and it's not the first time. They're helpless to do anything about it. In 1926, they're helpless to do anything about it. He goes in, does this, comes outside. The father makes a comment to him, and he shoots him dead in the field and just walks away. It's not a big deal. He walks around with a gun on his own property. You're on his property. 1926, not slavery, and he shoots the man dead, and there's no consequence to it. And for that man to go through all this thing that he did, that Forrest Whitaker's for character, and to end up at the end of the picture, shaking hands and being with the first black president of the United States, you know, was just, that to go from where he started to that is just, that impressed me more than anything I've seen this year. I mean, to start at nothing and to hear, to walk into a private audience with the President of the United States to honor him. The President of the United States honored him. And to see that, I can't get over that. That's the most, nothing impressed me more than that this year.
Well, what are you going to say for Oprah's part?
Oprah, now that's the thing too. What made the butler really work to me was that Oprah was not a saint. And that was good writing. She succumbed to the. She's married to Forrest Whitaker. He's the star. He's the focal point of the story. She's married to him, but because his duties took him away from home all the time, and because Terrence Howard, he has a power with the ladies, you can see that. I mean, he's such a good actor. You could see where it would be hard for anybody to female to resist him, and he was the kind of character that this is what he did. He did it in such a subtle manner. He didn't actually. They don't show him charming her, but he's charming in the sense that he's different. He's unique, and there's just something about him that you could see where he was just had that. He had, as Kramer would say on Seinfeld, he had the Kavorka.
And he's Terrence Howard.
She was unfaithful to her husband in this with Terrence Howard was what made her human. It made her better than the normal Ozzie and Harriet character where she's just the perfect little wife. She was strayed, but she didn't want to stray, but she strayed because her husband's duties took him away from home too often, and he couldn't participate with her in family things, I thought that was just wonderful that they didn't try to make her perfect, because that's the normal thing is everybody in the family's perfect. No, she strayed. She was a good woman. She loved her husband, but she strayed, and you could understand the stress she was under too. His job was stressful for him, and it was stressful for her. and she didn't get any of the benefits of it. You know, at least he, you know, he was actually doing the job, but she was at home being stressed out by the fact that he was never at home because he was basically on a 24-hour schedule with the president at the White House. So I thought that was just wonderful writing, and Oprah did a great job and making her character realistic and not just this ideal wife that long suffering. They didn't do that. That really impressed me.
The other big thing in the well, not in the movies, but actually on television is Scandal. Now, I don't know how much of that you've watched. I'm sure you have.
I've never watched it. And I've never, I'm not even clear all the time that it's a TV show or what it is, but I've never watched it. I just haven't.
It's real life? Now,
I never hear a bad thing about it. I mean, people love it, but I've just never watched it.
Well, I tell you what, I watched it every episode last year on time, and this year I got caught up to about, well, so many things that happened, I was like, you know, I was DVRing it, so I was like seven behind. And I mean, and I got ripped so bad by my wife, by my daughters. I haven't watched it. So I had to do a marathon catch-up, about seven episodes. And it's very, very, very unique. You wonder how they can come up a change so far down the line that is going to make a difference in what you saw seven episodes previous, but they do, and you I was watching I'm trying to remember what thing. Oh, I was watching Hawaii 5-0. Speaking about that, and you know, I'm still with the major one, with the original series, but I like this one. It's fairly good. I think it was a lot more. I think this one has a lot more lighter humor in it, a lot more than the original one did. But I was watching it, I'm like five behind on that, so I was trying to catch up. And some of the things that they get themselves involved with, some people might not notice, but, you know, like when you're being chased by the bad guys and you kill them and you use a machine gun to kill them, and then you say, well, what's going to get out of here? And you just you don't have a gun, but you throw down the machine gun you just used to kill these people, and you know there's more after you. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me. Little things like that. Why would you throw the gun away when you're not getting on a plane, you're not getting on a boat, you're not getting on a train where it might have to be checked, but you know some other people are chasing after you? Why would you just throw it down like, ooh, I don't know why I have this in my hand? I mean, especially when you're a cop. So, you know, things like that bother me, because then they go right back in the next episode and you see they could have used that machine gun. So things like that. Have you noticed in films, which really bothers me a lot, that you'll see the continuity not in what you saw in the film, but the continuity in writing doesn't match up what should have been done? And there seems to be no reasonable explanation why.
Continuity, the mistakes. And the thing about it is, like you're saying, sometimes they're subtle, and, you know, it's not, I mean, the old continuity mistakes used to be, you know, like, for instance, there's a famous episode of the TV show Dragnet, the old Jack Webb Dragnet, where a guy is arrested. He's got blood on his shirt from a fight. He gets on the elevator, and there's no blood on his shirt. And then when the elevator gets upstairs, there's blood on his shirt again. And they explain it became a famous thing. And they explain one scene was shot on Wednesday. Then the next scene of the fight was shot on Wednesday. Getting on the elevator was shot, let's say, on Friday, but getting off the elevator upstairs wasn't shot until Monday. So over the weekend, they forgot about the blood, and they gave him a new wardrobe, gave him a new shirt with no blood on it. you know, things like that, those kind of continuity mistakes. Now, that's not I guess they, because of all the taping and things now, they don't make big mistakes like that. But like you're saying, the mistake is in the writing. That you're right, that they forget things, you know. The other thing is, I mean, I saw a continuity mistake they showed you where it was about the shadow. It was a Western where the guy rides in and the shadow's on the right side of his face. The sun is shining on the left side of his face or something like that. And then he gets off his horse to have this gunfight and it's on the other side of his face. Because it was 4 hours later by the time they got to the gunfight scene. And, you know, but I mean, that's such a minor mistake. But that's just a technical mistake. And it's not a really mistake because who cares? That's not even worth talking about. But
that is
inconsistency. You know what it is, Mikey, I think it is? It's sometimes it's a thing by committee. There's more than one writer and stuff like that. And so some guy says they give him a machine. Somebody writes in a machine gun for him to survive the battle. And then the next guy, maybe he was responsible for the next scene, and he just didn't realize that he should carry over this machine gun because he didn't write that scene. You know, I think something like that comes up.
Well, that is true. But yeah, the thing that gets me is that she killed the three guys after she took the machine gun away from the first guy and killed the other two guys. But then she just throws it down on the ground and says, look, let's get out of here. I mean, and then you find out in the next, which was the end of that particular episode, and the next episode they're running and they don't have no gun to fight with. I mean, this is completely ludicrous. You know?
Yeah, but see, that's what I'm saying. I think that a lot of these things, Joe Smith wrote the first episode, and the second episode or the continuation episode was written by Bill Jones.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it. I don't think
it's
one person that consistently maybe writes the whole thing, or it's a team project. Because sometimes you can see that, they have a team of writers.
Right.
Now,
let me
just say something about writers. The greatest scene about writers is in the movie, what's the name of that movie? Hollywood, I can't remember the name of it now. But it's Tim Robbins takes over a movie studio. And he's taken over the movie studio because they went broke. And so they have a budget meeting. So they have all these people there in the budget meeting, and he's the new president of the corporation of the movie studio. And they're reading him their debts. So, you know, we spent so-and-so on insurance. We spent this much on vehicles. We spent this much on insurance for the sets and designs. And they're giving over everything. And then they come down to the thing where they said, and our salary for writers was our budget for writers was $6 million. And Tim Robbins says, no. He said, "What do you know?" Everybody's like, "What?" He says, "Why are we paying writers?" And you know, and they can say, "Well, you got to have." He said, "No, you don't." And he turns to the guy and says, "Give me the paper." And the guy passes him the newspaper. He says, "Husband kills wife and two kids after he loses his job. Man sets fire to train and kills four people before they can escape." He said, "This paper costs 35 cents. He said, "There's about 10 movies in this paper." He says, "Why are we paying somebody to write stories when we got stories every day?" He says, spend 35 cents, get the newspaper, go get some kid in college and let him write up a story based on the newspaper. He said, "The newspaper's a story. Every day the newspaper gives you a story. You don't need to pay writers." And what is that, Mikey? Law and Order. Every story on Law and Order is from the newspaper.
Right.
And they spend all
the
time telling you not based on anything that's real. Yes, it is. The Duke team had that trouble with the girl, thing with the girls being raped or something, assaulted at their party. And what, 3 weeks later, it was Law and Order had that same plot coming out. They didn't have it ready yet, but 3 months later they had it ready. And they say it has nothing to do with reality.
Yeah, so you're right. Well, you know, you were talking about that because they have a Law and Order UK, which I watch also, which is, you know, hey, it's written by the same it's not written by the same people here, but the supervisor script is everything based out of here, but it's done
and
in
it's
the
right
UK.
Out of the paper.
And it's right out of the paper. But because there's a because their laws are different, the way they go about solving the case, it's completely different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not going to get the guy and beat him up with a rubber blackjack, you know, over there. The cops can't even carry a gun. So, you know, when they're not busting in doors. They're not going to – they call out the special squad that does that. They don't have to do
right.
it. They never get themselves fighting with people. Very, very seldom. I think I only saw two fights where they actually had to fight somebody. But you're absolutely correct. But you're speaking about those that I think El Dorado was one of the famous continuity errors where they had in the end Robert Mitchum got shot and he had the crutch under his left arm. And then he changed it. When you saw him again, he had it under his right arm. Was the right arm first, then under his left arm, because he was standing walking next door to John Wayne, next to him, so he couldn't have the crutch on that side, so it would have been a bad shot. So anyway, but they have a lot of these that, and see, it bothers me. I can be sitting next to the kids, and wife, and they wouldn't even notice what was going on. I said, you see that would happen? I mean, I don't even get any sense. No. You know, you got to almost freeze frame it for them to see what's going on.
Yeah.
But,
and
now
because people have no idea, just cut it. But people have no idea about the time. You could shoot a scene, and the scene that's the next scene in the picture could still be 3 weeks away.
That's correct.
You know, you shot a scene. A guy's like you said. Let's say John Wayne's about to go in the bar. They shot a scene out in the street where they had a gunfight. Now he's about to go in the bar. The scene of walking into that bar could be 3 weeks later.
Absolutely.
And the continuity people have to keep track of the clothes and things like that. And then on the other hand, there's not that many people that would ever notice. So you can't get all wrapped up in, you know, well, he had a, you know, I mean, like they said, the thing about drinks, you know, that's one of the big continuity things. A person smoking a cigarette and the cigarette's almost out. And yet the next scene, the cigarette's back to being full length or it's not lit and it was lit before. And, you know, drinking their glasses, going up and down and up and down. But, again, there's not that many people that are going to catch these mistakes either.
Right,
you know,
absolutely.
Like you're saying, how many people are going to sit there and worry about whether the crutch was under his right arm or his left arm? So it's
that's true. Well,
sometimes it's not worth the trouble of but the thing is really the time difference. It can be months. They talk about, I'm getting back. But like when they film Jaws or something, there's something like they jump in the water for some scene, and then they come out of the water. They came out of the water. It was 3 weeks later.
That's right.
Because
that's
they
right.
filmed
that's
all the scenes of them jumping in the water at one time,
and
then coming out of the water was filmed at a different time. They didn't sit
there.
They don't care that you jumped in, and then I got to film you underwater cameras coming up. All the jumping in the water scenes were filmed at one time. And all the coming out of the water scenes where they needed an underwater camera to show you coming out of the water was filmed at a different time.
What is the, before we go here, what's your agenda between now and the end of the year? Which films do you have to see? Are you going to see?
No, it's up to me. When I was working for the Greenville paper, they told me what to see. And now that I'm working for the Brooklyn paper, I decide what I want to see. So I have no thing that I have to see. So what I do is like children's pictures. I don't do children's pictures like they used to assign me to a lot of children's pictures, which, you know, but I don't basically do children's pictures. If I do, I find some kids and I'll interview them about what they thought about the picture and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I want to see 12 Years a Slave, The Butler, Best Man reunion thing because it's you can actually do some good. For instance,
right.
Tyler Perry's Temptation. I saw it, and I had to warn the people, please avoid this picture like the plague. Oh, God, it was such a terrible, silly right. picture. It's like you could see. I wrote and I said I could have written this whole picture on the way to see the picture. It's just the most elementary plot. The good husband, wife meets this slick guy. Now the slick guy is going to take advantage of her, break up their marriage, and all that stuff. I mean, anybody could have told you 5 minutes into the picture the whole thing. You know, right. nothing in there that was any variation from the most basic plot that any junior high school kid could have come up with. And, so I wrote that to warn people, you got to be bad off to. And then they had a coincidence in there that was just unbelievable. It's just there was a coincidence in there that just the odds of this happening were 5,000 to 1. It's like somebody stole your watch or something in Chicago, and you walk into the only barber shop in Arkansas or something like that, and there's a guy wearing your watch on his, something like that. It's just, they had a ridiculous coincidence. So, I feel like I'm doing a public service when I warn people about those,
Right. Okay. And, we're having a shortened show today, and because I need to get to some more turkey, although I was kind of sick this morning, but there's always room for turkey. So
yeah.
I'm going to hold on 1 minute here. We got and we have on the show right now our resident Dr. Grace Leem. How are you?
Hey, Michael. I didn't know you were having John Bano with your house.
Oh, yes. He's
with the turkey?
Yes, it's a turkey. We were just talking about a list of turkeys a little while ago, but he was one of them. And,
definitely. Eric Cantor is another one, yeah. Senator Mitch Schindler, that's another one.
That's
yeah, and then your ex-Senator Jim Demented, there you go.
Jim Demented, that's right. I had Carla Cunningham on and a little while ago.
Yeah, Carla.
And she was telling us about the health care and how what is going on. She gave us a pretty good rundown on it. And but next Friday, we're going to have one of the people who was involved with a healthcare broker. So he's going to tell us about California, so he's going to be talking about that. And I hope
right.
that you could on. We only have about another 10 minutes for the show, 5 minutes for the show's over, because we've got a short show today. But I'd like to tell us, what have you heard so far?
About the healthcare exchange, yeah.
Yes. Huh?
You're talking about the healthcare exchange.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so let me tell you about the healthcare exchange and why things are more expensive here in North Carolina. Again, it comes back to refusing. They refuse two things. The Republicans in Raleigh refuse two things. One, refuse to expand Medicaid, and number two, they refuse to set up a state exchange. If they had set up a state exchange, we would really have a true concept of the free market. You would have competition, and if you have competition, obviously the prices are going to drop. Right now, there's zero competition. Let me tell you, the competition is basically between Blue Cross Blue Shield and Coventry. That's it. And Coventry is cheaper. Not by much, but it's cheaper. And there you are. That is no competition at all. But you can thank, and this is what we have to keep reminding people, you can thank the morons in Raleigh who refused to set up a state exchange. Not only did they make things more expensive for us here, but they also, on top of it all, denied us about 5,000 jobs. We could have created about 5,000 jobs. Well, how about 1,000? How about 5 jobs? How about 50 jobs?
Yeah.
How about 100 jobs?
We could have created jobs here in North Carolina.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
And because they refused to do so, we not only lost the jobs we could have created, we lost the money we could have gotten from the federal government. and we lost appropriate coverage, not only for extreme poor, but also for, you know, the average person. So I had a patient come in the other day, and she was all serious. And mind you, this is a free clinic. She was all serious about Obamacare because who can afford Obamacare? I can't afford Obamacare. And I sat down and pointed out to her and said, look, because you're in the position you're in, you would have received, okay, a stipend to pay for your insurance. Oh, really? She said, I didn't know that. Because I asked her, where do you get your information? Oh, it's all over the news. It's all over TV. And, of course, it's all over Fox News. And it's all, right, because Fox. That's what she listens to. Exactly. Exactly. And, well, occasionally she listens to CNN. So I had to sit her down and explain this to her. And the thing is, once you explain it to people, they get it. They absolutely get it. Unless you're an absolute moron, of course. Well, there are those in there.
That's how we get these people, the people who are spouting all this stuff are people who have never investigated what they have. They don't even know what they have as far as health care. If they have it, they don't know.
Right. Right. It's the Go ahead.
It's only 2.5% of those actual people that are going to get an actual raise in their insurance premium, but they're getting more their insurance than they had before.
Right. And then the other question that I ask is, when was the last time your insurance rates went down on an annual basis? Never.
Never.
Never. It has never gone down. It's always
absolutely
gone up.
Correct.
So
well,
when you want to bitch about Blue Cross, about the private insurance companies that are raising, you know, they're raising because they want the profit. Do they honestly... I ask people, do you think that when Blue Cross Blue Shield raises your premium, that raised in premium goes to what, the government? No, it goes to Blue Cross Blue Shield. And then do you think it goes to the Blue Cross Blue Shield employee? No, it doesn't. It goes to the CEO. Think about
that's
that.
Right.
You know?
That's right. What's your schedule look like next Friday?
I'll book you in some time.
What's that?
What time?
About 4:35.
Perfect. That'll be fine.
I want to see if we can get Representative Beverly Earl on and Colin Cunningham on, because they're going to be doing something. We want to get some of their input that we want to merge that with yours. I'm also going to have this representative from the broker out in California. And I'd like to, get all your opinion to see where we're at, because the rollout is supposed to be finished by tomorrow, I understand.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, but we've got major increases in insurance in California and New York and even in Kentucky and Washington.
Yeah.
98,000 people have been hooked on chronics, as we say. So
there you go. There you go.
I want to leave now, but I want to make sure that you kiss the baby and kiss Joe.
In that order? Okay, I got it.
Whoever you see first.
All right, Michael. It was good talking to you. And you take care. All right.
Yep. Okay, bye-bye. This has been The Last Word. Yeah, we had a good show, shortened show, but, hey, what do you want me to tell you? I'm going to go have a little bit of libation now, and hope everybody has a good weekend. This has been The Last Word. I'm Michael Lawson. Good.